May the words of our mouths and the meditations in our hearts be always acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer.
Amen.
You know, it seems as if in the Episcopal Church and in the Anglican Communion worldwide, we have gone from one little crisis to another over the last 40 or 50 years. But before that, there was a long period of peacefulness within the church. Back when I was first ordained in around 19, or was it 18? 1950 or 51 or 2. But somehow or another, beginning in the 60s and 70s, we've just gone from one sort of crisis after another. And a crisis can be a destructive thing, but it can also be an opportunity for growth within our church, and some of these have been. I can remember when the National Church decided that we would pass the peace. And I asked the congregation that I was serving then, I said, you know, please trust me and don't say anything about this, just do it for 6 months and then we'll talk about it. So they did. And so after 6 months, I said, okay, now I sat down like this up front. Now let's talk about this passing of the peace. Well, a former senior warden stood up right away. He was the first one up. He says, well, I'll tell you one thing. You've got to be very careful whom you sit next to. And then came the new prayer book. And of course, the University of the South at Sewanee, where one of our seminaries is, the English department, tore the new prayer book apart and said, it's horrible English, it just never should be written. And I kind of liked it pretty good, and I got a group of people of different ages together, and we celebrated the communion service just in one of the office buildings there. And again, one of the elder senior men there, afterwards I said, well, what do you think? He said, well, I'll tell you one thing, it's pretty clear what it means. And I thought, well, that's really good. It does that. And so there's some of these things that worked out good. I don't think most of us today, we like the second rite to the communion service, which we'll be doing today, and particularly the communion service that is called A. And I think it's very clear and it's beautifully written, I believe. And now, recently, we've been confronted with two things, and I'm going to do one today, and well, the one I'm going to do today is the crisis over homosexuality. And as you know, that what that really threw everything into a controversy was when a priest was elected. He was a practicing open gay man living in a dedicated relationship with another man up in New Hampshire, and he was elected bishop of New Hampshire. And with that, you thought the world was coming to an end in a way that happened, and it was terrible. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And I will make a distinction between when I'm speaking as to what the church is teaching nowadays and what is my own personal opinion. And being 89 years of age, I have a right to that. And then for the next 2 weeks after that, I'm going to divide that one into two parts, but it's going to be our whole question of what to do with militant Muslim religion and the notion of the terrorist attacks upon us, and what should the church be doing about that. We don't really know exactly what sex meant 5,000 years ago, but we do know that somewhere along the line, and it wasn't known at first, but somewhere along the line they began to put together that the sexual relationship between a man and a woman could result in having a baby. And because of the 9 months period normally of gestation, they didn't necessarily put the two together. And as a matter of fact, we can see evidences in the B.C. period, back before Jesus, that people thought that pregnancy was a result of prayer, and it was a miracle to have a baby. And they didn't particularly relate it to anything that we did. And then finally, it became evident that that's what was happening, and that was a real addition to knowledge. Meanings have been added to the sexual act over the centuries, and values have been added to it, and some of these have been very good, and some have been not so good. One of the things that we've become much more conscious of in recent years is how, particularly within men, sex can be a power play, that it's a means of conquering a woman, a means of having a victory over her. And this is what's behind rape in most cases. It's a horrible crime. I've personally never understood how anybody could do that, but I remember reading with horror during the controversies over when Yugoslavia broke up and you had the Serbs and the Muslims there. That was an awful thing. And there was one story that I don't remember which side this man was on, but he grew up next to this girl in a town. And now he was in a uniform and he came home and found her. And he raped her and then cut her throat, killed her. How could you wrap sex around that? But it can be done. And some of it's horrible. And that's why the church has to get involved in these things and pray through them and work through them and then make some judgments just to say, this is a no-no. We're not going to do that. That's not God's will. And yet somehow or another, the church has always felt that there is something potentially beautiful in human sexuality that can be blessed and be called one of God's greatest gifts given to us. But we've always understood that the sexual life of human beings, particularly with men, is very difficult to control. And yet we have to do that. By the time of the Old Testament period, there were certain assumptions about sex that I just want to mention in passing and not take too much time with that. But it was assumed that every individual had the ability to control his sexual life. That he wasn't, none of it was a given that he was going to behave in a certain way. So therefore, for instance, rape or adultery or something like that, you could say this is wrong. This is a violation of what God intends for sex to be. And therefore, if you do it, you are responsible for it because you didn't have to do it. That's the idea there behind that. And they became, by the Old Testament period, became more and more convinced in terms of the values that could be seen in the potential of sexual expression. The values would be, they would, if somehow or another, it had to do with interpersonal relationships. But sex with children? No. Rape? No. Adultery? No. And of course, back just at the time of the Old Testament period coming in, it was not uncommon for sex to be done with animals, particularly sheep. And that was then condemned as not right, no good. But in the Old Testament period, prostitution was seemingly tolerated, at least. And you could have more than one wife for a long period of time in the Old Testament, if you could afford it. At the time of the New Testament, however, a great step, some of it seems to me, and this is my personal opinion, to be a step forward, and some of it seems to be a narrowing of sexuality. And it was limited. By the time of the New Testament, sexual activity was limited to the state of marriage, so that prostitution was not considered good. And it was limiting of marriage to one man and one woman, not multiple wives. Yet in the narrowing, and this is kind of what's sad about that period, the narrowing of Paul never married. And in Corinthians, he says, I wish that everybody would be like me. Well, I've never wanted to be like Paul. At least in that regard. But the reason why he had that, and I understand this, and it's okay, he thought the end of the world was coming right away. He thought Jesus was going to return even in his lifetime. And therefore, because of that, why bother with it all? And he would say, but if you want to get married, it's okay, it's legal. You can do it. And then St. Augustine, 400 years later, St. Augustine wrote in his book that he would pray and hope that everybody would give up all kind of sexual activity so that there would be no more children. That's what he did. And he was a wonderful theologian, very brilliant, and a lot of the stuff that he wrote is powerful and beautiful. But I don't think this was too good. And he knew that Jesus wasn't coming tomorrow. And why he did that, he just said, felt that that was not a good thing. Oh, I have to tell you this. In his Confessions of St. Augustine, he did write this line. He said, I pray that God will make me chaste, but not just yet. But in the New Testament period, everything about sexuality that wasn't related to one man and one woman was considered sinful, and it was condemned. Now, they picked up and carried with it. Even in the Old Testament, homosexuality was considered a willful act by normal people to do the wrong kind of sexual activity, and therefore sinful. And that was carried over into the New Testament. If you want to do it, it's in the 18th chapter of Leviticus, and then it's in the Epistle to the Romans, and in Corinthians, it's condemned as being sinful. The only place in the ancient world, in the New Testament time and before, where homosexuality was tolerated and not necessarily considered bad was in Greece. And the Greek culture did seem to have a tolerance for that. Now, in the last 50 years, when our attention has been given over to the nature of human sexuality and the purposes of human sexuality, trying to salvage the beauty of it and the good things part of it, and then to weed out the things that seemingly are destructive about human sexuality, and a lot of it is. There are two areas where we have gained a great deal of knowledge. And one of these is we have been more open and reflective on people's experience with sex. We've talked about it, all the way back to the Kinsey people, different groups of that. When I was in New Orleans, I worked very closely with the psychoanalytic people there. And they had, didn't think I'd ever forget this. It was a man and a woman. Who was it? Somebody tell me who that was.
Masterson Johnson.
That's it, Masterson Johnson. Well, they were coming to New Orleans to give a talk to the psychiatric profession, and my friends invited me there. And they had been experimenting with curing male impotence by having them use prostitutes in their laboratory. And they had been invited by Hefner in Playboy to go to California and give a lecture out there on their studies in that laboratory. But when they hit New Orleans, they had to, and they did tell us with great grief and anguish among themselves, that they had come to the conclusion that sexual promiscuity was contrary to the nature of human sexuality. And instead of curing impotence, it created more impotence, particularly among males. And they didn't know what they were going to do when they got out to California. How they were going to get all that money out of Hefner and still be honest to their researchers. But see, this opened up the ability for people to say, this is what I'm experiencing. So human experience and the talking about human experience has been a source of growing knowledge. And I come back to that wonderful hymn that we didn't sing, but we read last week, where James Russell Lowell writes that line. What is that? New? I'm not too functioning too well this morning. He says, time makes ancient truths uncouth. In other words, with the passage of time, that which we used to think was really true turns out in subsequent experiences, we have to say, no, it's not true anymore. It's not true. And that's some of the things that we have learned about human sexuality. The other area is science. And what can science tell us about human sexuality? So these two things have been very important to us. Now, people, this is for the church. This is not John Jenkins, although I agree with this. But I'll tell you, when I put my opinion here, and the church is not against my opinion, but it's not necessarily for it. And that is this: by the basis of human experience, and I have to tell you, I was trained, psychiatrically trained in New Orleans. I didn't have an MD, of course, but so I didn't practice psychiatry. But I've been pretty well trained. And that has been important to me over the years. And my experience, and I have counseled with an awful lot of homosexual, both men and women. And one of the things that I've learned over the experience, that at least when a person, individual, first realizes that they are attracted to the same gender, and I like that word, gender, is not something that they chose, that it seemed to be a given, almost like a biological, glandular necessity to come to that conclusion about themselves. I've never had an individual say, now, after they had admitted it to themselves, and over the years, if you said, would you like to change back and be heterosexual? A lot of times they would say, no, I don't want to change back. But initially, when it first starts, there is a notion there that something's wrong with me. And the culture said something's wrong with you. Now, people, we know this from raising children, that if you tell a child that he's no damn good, the child is going to grow up believing I'm no good. And so, no wonder that many people who became aware of their homosexuality didn't know what to do with it, and in a way turned destructive, because they loathe themselves for being that way, considering that the culture said, it's your fault, you don't have to be that way. Now, my experience with it is, in counseling, I'd have never seen a person that said, I have chosen this way. Now, science comes along and says, you've got a reason for that, and that is genetics. And we're knowing now much more about it, and I don't know anything about genetics at all, except what I've read in general. And more the geneticists are saying that there's a whole lot that is determined by our genes. There may be your proclivity toward, well, right now, we're seeing more and more, there is a proclivity in women, certain women, more than others, to have breast cancer as a genetic drive. And they've turned and said, it's very possible that the movement of your whole psyche in terms of a homosexual relationship is a genetically driven thing. And that supports at least what most of us in counseling would come up and say, this is seemingly what homosexual people are trying to tell us, that we didn't choose this way, but we are this way. And as I say, many of them, after some years, do not want to change anyway. And if they did try to change back, they would probably not be able to. So that's it. That's rather important. And the church began to, it got by in the 1970s and 80s, the church began to come to a realization that we do not say that if you are a homosexual individual, that that's a sin. And we moved that way. We had a marvelous bishop of Atlanta, Georgia, who wrote a paper in the 1970s. And what in that paper, which he distributed all over the Episcopal Church, said, in effect, is a distinction he makes, that my preference in terms of my makeup, if I'm a homosexual person, is a given. I don't choose it. But what I do with that, I can choose. And that was accepted by the Episcopal Church. And it was accepted and passed in a resolution by the General Convention. And the Lambeth, which meets every 10 years, of all of the bishops all over the Anglican Communion, in the late 1990s, the Anglican Communion accepted the fact at Lambeth that your gender preference is not something you choose, it's given by nature, and therefore is not a sin. For something to be a sin, you have to willfully choose to do it. So that now raises the question, what do you do with it once you say that you are not at any fault whatsoever if you say that you are a person drawn to individuals of your own gender? What do you do with it? Well, Bishop Sims said he would send a person to seminary that wanted to be a priest if they said, I'm gay. But he would make them vow celibacy. Now, most of the church is not with Bishop Sims now on that. They would say that to tell a person that if you are a gay person and you cannot do anything with it to express your sexuality with another gay person, is that a sin? Well, Bishop Sims said it would be. And people have said, no, that can't be right. And that's where the church is today. The national church would say that if you want to say that a person can express their sexuality, physically express it, if you are a gay person and you do it willingly with another gay person, that's okay. That will be left, this is the policy of the church, that will be left to each diocese and the bishop of each diocese. Now, what many of the bishops have done have said, that's probably true, that's probably a good idea, but I'm not going to make it a law in my diocese. Now, that's where Duncan Gray is. And he has now said that when he's leaving the episcopate, that he is telling every parish church, you can decide what you want to do if you want to take two males, let's say, and perform the rite of marriage. So could you do that? Because you would express that, say that these persons have every right, and it's not a sin for them to express their sexuality in a physical way with another person. And we're left now to St. Peter's Parish if it comes up. Now, if it's a big parish, you're going to have it come up more frequently, probably. I've certainly confronted it. I want to go now to where the church is, but I don't think the church fully appreciates where it is. Here's what I'm talking about. In your marriage service, there's the word in there, into this union. Pull your prayer book out there. And this is important, so I'm looking for the marriage service. It's about page 400 and something. Here it is.
What page number?
It's page 423. Dearly beloved, we've come together in the presence of God to witness and bless the joining together. That would be union. I'm going to do that because I'm going to give you the Greek word for that. Of this man and this woman. Now see, there's a presupposition that it has to be a male and a female in holy matrimony, in marriage. The bond and covenant of marriage was established by God in creation and goes on. Now, listen to this. The union of husband and wife in heart, body, and mind is intended by God for their mutual joy, for the help and comfort given one another in prosperity and adversity, and when it is God's will, for the procreation of children. Now there are several of the purposes. For their mutual joy and for the sharing of life's adventures in prosperity and adversity. Now the word here in Greek that's used for union, the union of man and woman in marriage, is the word enosis. Enosis. That's what enosis means. And that's what I think the church believes, that there is a bonding. And that bonding together, for the church is concerned, a man and a woman. Now what about if it's two men or two women? Can they experience a enosis? Now that's where the church has never come up with an answer to that. And for the most part, the church and Lambeth and the diocese around the world of the Anglican Communion, with the exception of Canada, Australia, and the United States, all the other places in the Anglican Communion have said, no, it's got to be for it to be a henosis, a bonding together in marriage. It has to be between a man and a woman, not any gay person. The American church has said, we leave that open, that you can do it. But the rest of this is what caused. You remember when we had the split right here in this parish, when our two priests wanted to leave because they wanted to follow some of the bishops and archbishops down in Africa and on there. It was over this issue right here. That was the main issue that was the problem with it. And they said the American church is being led astray. Now, here is going to be my thought. I think that the rest of the Anglican Communion has made the word enosis, the union between two people, too narrow. That it is a beautiful concept. There is within human nature something that arises at a certain period in life when you really seek to reach over and be bonded to somebody else. And I'm going to broaden it here a little bit. Now watch this. It comes not when you're 5 years old, but it comes when you get into your teens and you begin to leave father and mother and you go out on your own. Yes, you need to do that to establish your own ego, your own self as a person. But then, shortly thereafter, and almost simultaneous with your independence from mama and daddy, you're not an appendage. And I like to say that when I was 5 years old, I was that Jenkins boy. But by the time I was 18 years old, I was that John Jenkins boy, a unique, separate individual from my mother and father. But then, simultaneous with that then, becomes a sense of aloneness. I'm alone. And I yearn to somehow or another be bonded. There is your word, enosis. Be bonded in union with somebody. And I'm saying that somebody does not have to be a male or a female alone. That the same experience will happen with two men or two women. And that yearning, that independence will come, and then that yearning to somehow or another be united in a bond between two people. And people, please trust me, I have listened to too many gay people over the years who have had excruciating pain in their lives by that loneliness when they didn't feel that they could express it. Now here, listen to this. This is Thomas Wolfe in Look Homeward, Angel. A stone, a leaf, an unfound door. Of a stone, a leaf, a door. Now think about the word door. And of all the forgotten faces, naked and alone we came into exile. In her dark womb we did not know our mother's face. From the prison of her flesh have we come into the unspeakable an uncommunicable prison of this earth. Which of us has known his brother? Which of us has looked into his father's heart? Which of us has not remained forever in prison? Which of us is not forever a stranger and alone? O waste of loss in the hot mazes lost. Among bright stars on this most weary, unbright sender, lost. I love this last line. Remembering speechlessly, we seek the great forgotten language. What's he talking about? The ability to commune deeply with another human being and to feel bonded to that human being. You all have felt that. The great forgotten language, the lost lane into heaven, a stone, a leaf, an unfound door, where, when, O lost and by the wind grieved ghost, come back again. There is the deepest yearning for somehow or another to be in communion with another human being on a deep level. Are we going to say that's confined just to a man and a woman? Your church doesn't know. It doesn't have an answer to that. It leaves it to the bishop. And the bishop is now leaving it to the parish. Because if you say, no, they can, a gay person can do it, then we can rewrite the marriage service. Now, Thomas Wolfe never experienced it. He spirits the hunger for it. But he lived a tragic life of a sense of aloneness within that. I have no idea whether Thomas Wolfe was gay or not. Don't know. Have any idea. Now I want to contrast that with a person who has experienced that bonding. Now, the difference between a man and a woman. It's Major Sullivan Ballou, a major in the Confederate War on the Union forces. He wrote a letter to his wife. A week before the Battle of Bull Run. The indications are very strong that we shall move in a few days, perhaps tomorrow. And lest I should not be able to write you again, I feel impelled to write a few lines that may fall under your eyes when I am no more. Sarah, my love for you is deathless. It seems to bind me with mighty cables that nothing but omnipotence can break. And yet my love of country comes over me like a strong wind and bears me irresistibly with all those chains to the battlefield. The memory of all the blissful moments I have enjoyed with you come crowding over me, and I feel most deeply grateful to God and you that I have enjoyed them for so long, and how hard it is for me to give them up and burn to ashes the hopes and future years when, God willing, we might still have lived and loved together and seen our boys grown up to honorable manhood around us. If I do not return, my dear Sarah, never forget how much I loved you, nor that when my last breath escapes me on the battlefield, it will whisper your name. Forgive the many thoughts, the many pains I have caused you. How thoughtless, how foolish I have sometimes been. But, oh, Sarah, if the dead can come back to this earth and flit unseen around those they love. I shall always be with you in the brightest day and in the darkest night, always. And when the soft breeze fans your cheek, it shall be my breath, or the cool air your throbbing temple, it shall be my spirit passing by. Sarah, do not mourn the dead. Think I'm gone and wait for me, for we shall meet again. Hey, Major Ballou was killed a week later at Bull Run. He found it. He found that enosis with Sarah. My own opinion is that two gay men or two gay women can do the same. I find that this yearning to somehow or another be bonded to another human being is universal all over the world. In the Hindu scriptures, this is the origin of something very powerful. In the beginning, there was myself alone in the shape of a person. He, looking around, saw nothing but himself. And he first said, "This is I." Therefore, he became I by name. But he felt no delight, and therefore a man who is lonely feels no delight. He wished for a second. He was so large as man and wife together that he made this his self to fall into two pieces. This is where we get the phrase, my better half. And thence arose husband and wife. And therefore the gods said, we too are thus, like half of a whole piece. He embraced her, and men were born. I know that you see that is divided into male and female of me. And here again, the procreation was there. But the important thing is the yearning to be related in a enosis with one another. Now, the lesson we read from the Old Testament, Genesis, that which Eve is was taken from Adam's rib. In other words, that which now Adam lacks is what Eve is. Can you see the connection? And it goes on, it says, and for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother, and here, watch this verb, and cleave, that is strong, cleave to his wife, and they too shall become one. That's enosis. Well, that's enough of that. When we go over to the church, those would wish to, somebody gets over there before I do, go sit far down to this end so we won't disturb people who don't want it. But we will talk if anyone wants to raise questions or tell me that I don't know what I'm talking about. That's fine enough. I've heard that before. And I sometimes believe it. I hope we will be in this parish church, open and embracing of all people, for your church nationally has taken the viewpoint that the selection of your gender and your sexual preference is not a matter of choice, it's a matter of being given. And I take it further. I say that therefore, because it is given, that person has every right to yearn for and crave to be bonded in a henotic relationship with a person of the same sex.